This is Steph from Voices in the Valley. We're breaking format here today on the show to give you the full interview with author Steve Snyder as he discusses his book Shot Down, a memoir that has received 20 national book awards. Steve's out in California, so we recorded this interview on my iPhone. Hope you enjoy it, and may we always remember. I am on the phone with Steve Snyder, author of Shot Down, the true story of pilot Howard Snyder and the crew of the B-17 Susan Ruth. Steve graduated from UCLA with a degree in economics and spent 36 years in national sales and management before retiring. Upon retirement, he began to research the experience of his father, pilot Howard Snyder, and the crew of the B-17 Susan Ruth. In the process, he became a World War II historian and is a member of numerous World War II associations, including being president of the 306th Bomb Group Historical Association. Steve, welcome to Voices in the Valley.
Well, thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
I am thrilled to have you here to converse with us about a topic that is of so much interest to so many people, and also a topic that, you know, if not recorded and discussed and remembered, will soon be out of the minds of people as our World War II veterans begin to pass on. I mean, and I think many of them already have, because they'd be in their 90s now, wouldn't they, most of the people who would have participated in World War II?
Oh, yes. They're basically all in their 90s. The oldest World War II veteran right now is 111. There were 16 million World War II veterans, and now there's less than 600,000. They're passing at about 400 a day. So fortunately, it won't be long before we've lost them all, which is just an absolute shame.
It is, especially when they so deserve the title, The Greatest Generation, which is why, really, the book that you have written, Shot Down, is such a blessing to people to have, to be able to read and to experience the truly heroic and courageous efforts of these women and men, and really not only in our own country, but in Europe and all over the world. You know, Steve, I have to be honest, I read the book and it was just gripping. I started it and I read it almost all in one day because I couldn't put it down. And then I started thinking about this interview and what we were going to talk about. And there were so many things I wanted to ask you and so many things I wanted to find out from you that I just want to take a moment right now to encourage our listeners to pick it up and to read it, because really there is so much good stuff, not only from a human interest standpoint, but from a historical standpoint and even from a cultural standpoint, that it's not only an entertaining read, which is good, but I think even more importantly, you really capture something that is of such essence to what it means to be an American. And so I first want to start out by just thanking you for taking the time to do the research and to write the book and to make this available to us to be able to not only enjoy, but really be inspired by as well. So Steve, thank you for that.
Well, thank you for saying that. I appreciate it. It was really an honor and a privilege to both do the research and to write the book and publish the book.
I'm sure it was quite a journey, and I'm going to look forward to asking you about that a little bit later in our interview, because I know there are a lot of people who would like to write a memoir, and you've done a stunning job of taking a personal story related to your family and really grounding it into the historical and cultural context of the times in a way that is quite meaningful. And so later in the interview, we'll discuss how you did that and maybe some of the challenges and some of the joys that you had in that process. But for now, what I decided I really want to focus on is something that comes through loud and clear in the book, which is the incredible courage of these men, their families, and the people who risk their lives to assist them. Because if there's one thing, at least for me, that stood out on every page is just the enormous amount of fortitude and courage it took to do what needed to be done in a way that was so necessary during that very turbulent period of our country. At the beginning of the book, you, of course, have the men going off to war. And one thing that sort of surprised me, to be honest, was at the beginning, there was almost the anticipation. It was kind of exciting. You know, they were going off. I believe, you know, Howard Snyder starts out in Gander, Newfoundland, Canada, where they're preparing the planes to take off for England. And there were, of course, many training activities that they did at that time, but there were also social activities with the local civilians. And I thought it was interesting, the letter that your father wrote back to your mother. Steve, could you share that letter with us and just kind of put it into context?
Sure. Well, at that time, you know, the country was much more rural than it is today. A lot of these guys being so young, you know, as young as 17, 18, a lot of them had never been out of their hometown or home state. So going halfway around the world or the anticipation of that was exciting to them. And when the war broke out, when Pearl Harbor was bombed, you know, everyone just rushed to the enlistment offices trying to get involved in the war effort. But this one portion of a letter, and there's lots of excerpts from my dad's letter to that he wrote to my mother in the book. But this one goes, and I quote, "I hope we get weathered up here for a while. It's pretty nice, and we're getting extra overseas pay. We're having a good time. If it weren't for the fact that I'm away from you, Princess, I would not miss this for the world. I suppose I will wish before long that I was back home. But right now it is pretty exciting, not knowing what kind of country we're flying over to next. The suspense of the unknown is exhilarating. After being a homeboy for so long and finally having something like this happen, it's like a book, only I wish it could have happened before I met you," unquote.
Yeah, no, it's just, it's wonderful. And in the whole book, you weave through the letters that your father wrote to your mother as he participated in the war. And that anticipation in many ways turned to horror and even terror with the things that they saw and had to do and what happened with the war effort. I was also really struck by a letter wrote by air captain, or was he a pilot, I believe, Joe Muzio? Was he a pilot? I can't remember.
No, he was a technical sergeant. He was actually a waist gunner on my dad's B-17 crew. A B-17 had a 10-man crew, and he was one of two waist gunners.
And what's so interesting about him is that he was on his second set of missions, that he had actually completed a first round, that he could have gone home and stayed home. But instead, he chose to re-enlist and to participate again. And he writes this letter, and it really is extraordinary because in it, he talks about why he is going to re-engage in the effort. And I don't want to say more than that because really he does such a profound job of explaining what his intention is. And so I'm hoping you would read that letter for us as well.
I will. You know, actually, he was stationed at Pearl Harbor. He was on a B-17 crew in the Pacific, and he was on Pearl Harbor the day it was bombed by the Japanese. And he had completed, like you said, 72 missions in the Pacific, and they sent him home, but he didn't want to stay home. He wanted to go over to England and get back into the war. So his letter starts out, "Dear Mom, this is going to be quite a jolt to you, but I just can't take it here in the States. I know you will have a hard time understanding just why I should want to go again. It's just something that's in me, I guess. Maybe it's because I lost so many of my best friends. Or maybe I just can't stand staying on the ground and watching these new young boys go over into combat. They are so blame young. They really don't know what they're going into. Now, don't take it too hard and try to understand that it is what I've got to do to be able to live with myself, even though I know of what horror is ahead. Whether I come back or not is not important. Because when you realize all the suffering, bloodshed, and horror other people have already gone through in the occupied countries, even if I do give my life trying to help, it will be meager in comparison," unquote. That pretty much says it all.
It's so profound, and it gives me goosebumps. And it, I just, again, the courage and the character and the integrity that it takes to write a letter like that and then to go back into combat and to go on over into England. And especially because he, you know, at this point, he knew what he was getting into. He knew that this was not going to be fun and games. You know, it wasn't that initial anticipation of, oh, what's going to happen? And wow, this is exciting. We're doing this for a really good cause. I mean, he knew, as he says in the letter, that, you know, he might very likely never come back. And, you know, that was one of the other things that comes through really clearly in the book is not only the courage that these men showed, but also, you know, when they got over to England and they were stationed and they got ready for their mission and they knew that, you know, they had one job, one purpose, which was to bomb the strategic target that had been set before them, and they would get on those planes, they knew that chances were high that they would never come back. And I just think that's astounding, the ability to be able to get on and to do it. And, you know, I will say this, I had the privilege last year of interviewing another gentleman who was on one of those B-17 bombers, and he did do 25 raids. And, you know, I asked him, I said, how do you do it? And he said, you know what? You don't have a choice. You just do. You get on the plane and you do it. And that's your duty. That's your job. That's your responsibility. And so you do it. I think that's just amazing in so many ways.
Yeah, absolutely. They just looked like they just considered that they were doing a job. Someone had to do it, and they went and did it. Then they came back home, and to them, it was, they weren't heroes, although we know they were heroes. Being young guys, you know, in their late teens or early 20s, they felt invincible, and you know, they would just live forever, and it'd be the other guy that would be shot down or killed. And, you know, one thing, though, that they learned after being there for a while, that, you know, you didn't make a lot of friends, because if you'd made a lot of close friends, you might lose them. So it was better not to get too chummy with guys that were outside of your crew. You kind of stayed in your crew.
Yeah, and your crew really became like a family, didn't it? A second family.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they, you know, going through combat together, they bonded so extremely close. And after the men that made it back, my dad's crew, five of them made it back, five of them did not. But he kept in touch with those other four that returned, and they got together occasionally, and they definitely stayed in touch and maintained that relationship.
And that's one of the interesting things of many about your story that you've written and about the book, is that you follow these 10 men who get onto that fateful flight, and we find out what happens to each one of them. And, you know, some of them are, like your father, avoid being captured. Others are captured and become POWs. Others are executed. Some die on the plane. You know, you really feel like you are a part of the story when you're describing this. And so I'm wondering, can you take us on a B-17? Can you describe for the listening audience right now what that would be like to get onto the plane and get up and come into contact with the German, the other German airplanes, and what that might feel and look like?
Sure. Well, it was dangerous and deadly from the time they took off to the time they landed. There were 40 bomb groups in the 8th Air Force in England, and on the day of a mission, they were B-17s and B-24s taking off from all these bases, which were only like 5 to 10 miles apart at the same time. So just getting off the ground was a challenge. There wasn't any radar or air traffic control back then, and the weather was usually terrible. They couldn't see anything until they got above the cloud layer. So mid-air collisions forming up were not uncommon. And it took them an hour to 2 hours just to form up before they could ever head across the English Channel on their mission, because individual planes formed up into three-plane elements, elements formed up into squadrons, squadrons formed up into bomb groups formed up into bomb wings, wings formed up into air divisions. So it was really a complicated and lengthy task. And then they had the elements to deal with. These planes weren't pressurized. So it was freezing up there. It was minus 40 to 60 degrees below zero. And so frostbite was a huge problem. Many of the airmen were hospitalized with severe frostbite wounds. My dad's other waist gunner, John Pindrock, yeah, he suffered some severe frostbite wounds and was unable to fly for a couple months. And also above 10,000 feet, they had to go on oxygen. Or else they'd soon pass out, and in a couple minutes they'd be dead. So they had to deal with those elements. Then once they reached the continental coast of Europe, they had to deal with the enemy fighters. The Germans had radar stations set up along the coast of continental Europe, so they knew when these formations were coming. And the Luftwaffe, the German Air Force, would be waiting for them. And at the beginning of the war, especially in 1943, the 8th Air Force took devastating losses. Initially, there was no mission limit, and then in March of 43, they implemented the 25 mission limit. But statistically, it was impossible for any crewman to avoid being shot down. The average number of missions flown was only 6. And like you said earlier, I mean, these guys knew what they were getting into when they got in that plane and took off. It took an unbelievable amount of courage. And then when they got through the fighters and got near the target, Now, they ran into another problem, and that is anti-aircraft fire. The Germans had flak guns, they were calling them. Flak is an abbreviation for the German word for aircraft defense cannon. And those were deadly weapons. So they could fire 20 shells a minute, and they were calibrated to explode at the same altitude that the bombers were flying. And when these shells exploded, they were full of all different shapes and sizes of razor-sharp metal that would burst out hundreds of feet and easily penetrate the thin aluminum skin of these bombers. The skin was so thin you could just take a screwdriver and poke right through it. And I can't imagine what that must have been like. From a distance, these shells exploding like looked like innocent little black puffs. But as the planes got closer, those puffs got bigger and just violently rocked the ship. If one hit a bomber, direct hit, it would basically stick, the bomber would explode and disappear or knock off a wing and the bomber would drop like a stone. My dad said even though it was so cold and freezing up there, he would just be dripping in sweat and his clothes would be drenched from the adrenaline running through his body. And then once they dropped their bombs, they would try to form up again, those that made it through, and head back to England, and then they'd be engaged by enemy fighters once again. So it, and these missions lasted 8-10 hours long. So it was brutal up there.
Oh my goodness, absolutely. And I suppose it was only adrenaline, probably a whole lot of prayer that kept you going when you were up in the sky like that. You know, it's no secret, given that the book is called Shot Down, that your dad's plane, Susan Ruth, was indeed shot down. And, you know, as I mentioned before, and you mentioned, half the crew survived, half did not, and you detail the stories of what happened to each of them. But I want to leave that for the reader to pick up the book, because I don't want to give anything away, because it really is a gripping read. And instead, turn our focus on to the heroes on the ground in Belgium and in France, the resistance that took these airmen in as they came down from the sky, the ones who survived, of course, and hid them from the Nazis, who at the time were in both France and Belgium. Could you tell us a little bit about both the Freedom Trail and then also the French Maquis? Is that how it said, the guerrilla resistance group in France that your dad later joined?
Yes, the Maquis. They were the band of guerrilla resistance fighters. They were small bands and groups throughout France. But as you mentioned, airmen who were able to bail out and evade being captured, they were helped by the underground in Belgium or the Netherlands or in France. And they were amazingly brave people. They risked not only their lives, but the lives of their families aiding these downed airmen. And if the Gestapo or the German army units discovered that they were aiding an airman, they would be either shot or sent to prison, concentration camps, and some of the people that did help my dad and other members of his crew were arrested, tortured, sent to concentration camps, and some died. They were just unbelievable. My dad said that they would let him sleep in their bed. They'd sleep on the ground. They'd give him the most food to eat. They were just such courageous people. And typically what they the resistance or the underground tried to do when they picked up a downed airman is try to get him back to England. The Freedom Trail, as you mentioned, was really made up of a number of various escape routes. It would go down through France, over the Pyrenees into Spain, and then out through British-controlled Gibraltar, and then back to England. The most famous escape line was called the Comet Line, and it was actually organized and run by a 26-year-old girl. Her code name was Dee Dee. And they, it was a 1,200 mile route from France, you know, to Gibraltar, which was dangerous in itself, having to go over the Pyrenees. These guys didn't have any, you know, the clothing for it. They were just wearing what they had on when they bailed out. And so that was very treacherous. There was spies all along the route. There were about 2,000 people that participated in the Comet Line. And many of them were captured and interrogated, and many of them were executed, all aiding these downed airmen. So it was a treacherous trip. It's interesting to note that Dee Dee herself was arrested and interrogated and tortured. And then she finally admitted that she ran the Comet line, but the Germans didn't believe her because they didn't think a young 26-year-old girl, you know, had the capability of doing such a thing, so they let her go.
Wow, that's just stunning. Well, let's talk about the women at home, because obviously these servicemen also had family that was anxiously waiting to hear what was happening to them and what was going on in the war effort. And, you know, that just to me also stood out as another example of courage, because those families had to be going through so much stress and worry as they knew their servicemen were in peril and didn't always know what was going on. I know your mother at the time was pregnant. And
right.
What really struck me is that in the time between two telegrams that she received, the first one was from the War Department, and it said this: "The Secretary of War desires me to express his deep regret that your husband, First Lieutenant Howard J. Snyder, has been reported missing in action since 8 February over France. If further details or other information are received, you will promptly be notified." And then it has the signature of the Adjutant General. And then there was 7 months of silence where your mother and your father's family knew nothing about his whereabouts, what was going on, if he was alive, if he was dead, if they would ever hear from him. And honestly, I can't even think on how that would be, to be the mother of your oldest sister, pregnant with your second sister, and not knowing what had happened to your husband. It just had to be exceedingly worrisome and stressful on your mother. Did she ever talk on it?
Oh, yeah. His plane was shot down on February 8th, and that letter from the War Department she received was on February 23rd. And as you said, you know, he said he had a one-year-old baby girl, Susan Ruth, who my dad's plane was named after. And then my other sister Nancy, she was born while he was missing in action. So my mother, you know, with these two, one an infant, one a one-year-old, yeah, it was extremely hard for her. And she exchanged letters with either mothers or wives or sweethearts of other members of the crew. And a lot of those excerpts from those letters are in the book. And they're very moving because they were so worried, and they called them their boys, although in one letter, one of the mothers said, by the time they get through this, they will be men.
Yeah.
And just not knowing anything, but praying and hoping for the best, that somehow that they would surface and come back alive.
And that was really touching, too, how those families did interact and support each other through letters and through, I'm sure, the prayers that they shared over their servicemen. And, you know, what was must have been exceedingly hard as well is, you know, like you mentioned, half came back and half did not. And all of those families were interconnected at this time. And it had to be so bittersweet to get back your loved one, but know that someone who, another family that you had come to care for so much, had lost someone that they loved so dearly. And, you know, your mother went through 7 months of silence where she had no idea what had happened to your father. And then all of a sudden, one day, another telegram comes, and it's from your dad. And it's such a delightful telegram. I almost said he texted. He telegraphed, "Is that sweet little chin still up, baby? Back at face, fit as a fiddle. Will write, bank the money. Love, Howard Snyder."
Yeah, that's moving, isn't it? Yeah, he wrote that on September 8th, he actually met up with, he was fighting, he was hidden by Belgian people for a period of time, and something always went wrong trying to get him out through these escape routes. Some of them had been infiltrated by collaborators, and they didn't think it was safe, and he finally just got tired of hiding, so that's when he joined the French resistance, the Mackie, and started sabotaging German convoys. And on September 2nd, he heard that some Allied troops were nearby in a little village of Trelon, France. Actually, it was Patton's Third Army after they came up through France after D-Day. So he went into the village and identified himself and then went to Paris and then got back to September and sent that letter to or Western Union telegram to my mother on September 8th. And back then, you couldn't fly again if you were shot down over occupied territory. because they thought if you were shot down a second time, captured by the Germans and tortured, that you'd give up the identity of the underground people that helped you.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah, the only exception to that was fighter pilot Chuck Yeager, who met with General Eisenhower himself and convinced him to let him go back into combat.
Wow, that's really something. Well, let's switch gears here. This first portion that we've recorded is actually going to be the end of the radio episode on Voices in the Valley, because we're just not going to have enough time to go into researching the family story on Voices in the Valley as it's aired on the radio. But that said, we are fortunate that, you know, it's all about podcasts these days, and there's no limit on podcasting times. And so what we definitely are going to do is we will air the entire interview about the B-17 Susan Ruth and how it was shot down. But then for those who are interested in learning more about researching family story and how you did that, there will be a bonus on the podcast Voices in the Valley, which can be found on any of the podcast directories, including iTunes and Stitcher and Google Play Music and all of those. So before we switch gears, though, into researching family story and how you did this, let me ask you, what's the best way to find the book and to find out more information about the experience that your father had?
Well, the book itself can be found on Amazon, or it's at Barnes & Noble stores, or pretty much wherever books are sold. If they don't have it in stock, they can order it from their wholesale distributor. My website is stevesnyderauthor.com, and there's a great deal of information on my website, not only about the book and my dad's story, but about the 8th Air Force and the history of the air war over Europe itself. If anyone wants to email me directly, my email is steve@stevesnyderauthor.com. On my website, if you'd like an autographed copy, a signed copy of the book, you can order it on my website.
Oh, that's cool. Oh, that's awesome. Steve, this has been wonderful. Thank you so much for sharing about your father's experience and the experience of the crew on the Susan Ruth. Steve Snyder has written Shot Down, the True Story of Pilot Howard Snyder and the Crew of the B-17 Susan Ruth. You can learn more about Steve and his book at stevesnyderauthor.com. Steve, it's been fantastic. Thank you so much.
Well, I really appreciate the opportunity. It's been fun. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Well, thank you, Steve. And I definitely encourage our listeners to go out and read your book. It is a really stunning tribute to the courage of the men involved and a true testament of what it means to be an American. So thank you.
My pleasure. It's our duty to remember.
Absolutely. Thanks.
Hi, this is Emma Atkins, head writer for Hashtag Hush Podcast and actress who plays the role of Andy. The Hush team is comprised of teenagers from all over the St. Croix Valley who write, perform, and produce an original sci-fi radio series. You may have heard our previous episodes played the first Saturday of every month here on Voices in the Valley. But now we are thrilled to announce Hush is on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. Please find us on iTunes and subscribe, rate, and review your own hometown, homegrown podcast. Hush follows a teenage girl named Andy, whose parents and then grandmother mysteriously disappear. Andy and her friends set off to search for them on a quest that leads into multiple worlds filled with dangerous secrets and manipulative people, all kinds of fun characters. The voice of a strange being named Silence, a bumbling police officer who wants to train his pug to be a police dog, and well-intended but misguided adults aggravate the situation rather than making it better. It's been super fun to write and amazing to act in, and we want you to experience it too. So right after this episode of Voices in the Valley, check out iTunes, find Hush, subscribe, rate, and review. Also find us by Googling hashtag Hush Podcast. I hope you enjoy the show.
This is Steph from Voices in the Valley. I am at Stillwater Area High School right now with the poetry editors of the new youth literary magazine called The Boom Site, published by the Shire and inspired by the initiative of high schoolers here in the St. Croix Valley. I have the two poetry editors here. We've got Hannah. Hi, Hannah.
Hi.
And also Eleanor.
Hi.
Hannah and Eleanor, tell me about The Boom Site.
It features literary works and visual art done by youth in the Central Valley, and it's totally student-run, and it's really great.
Maybe, Hannah, you could tell me, how did students submit their work, and how was it determined what works would be in the Boom site?
So students would submit their work to the Boom site's email address, and then the works of poetry would be sent to Eleanor and myself, and we have a rubric which we went through and evaluated all the different works of poetry, the many, many works of poetry that we received. It was really great. Using the rubric, we decide which ones get published and which are not.
That's very neat. Then I'm assuming that the prose editors would do the same thing with the prose submissions, and then if there were visual arts submissions, that the visual arts editors would take a look at those as well.
Exactly.
And why should people subscribe to the Boom site?
Because it is so interesting to hear the voices of the youth in the St. Croix Valley, and I think the Boom site is such a great safe space for students to share their work, because sharing your writing, whether it's prose or poetry, is very personal, and I think the whole idea of the Boom site was creating that safe space for students to share, and I think that's a really unique thing.
That is a unique thing. And you can subscribe to the Boom site at theshireonline.com/boomsite, and it will land in your mailbox, neat and tidy and ready for you to read and enjoy. Eleanor and Hannah, thank you so much for telling us about the Boom site.